Almost there. Hey, there we are. Hey, folks. Thanks for tuning into the BAMF podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty. And today we are very happy to have Ron Mars of comics fame here with us today. How you doing, Ron?
Good. All things considered, very good. Okay. Hope you guys are safe and sound, too.
Yeah, just living my best life in this 200th day of March. So,
I'm not sure what year of March, but yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely a thing. And co-host today is frequent guest Paul. Say your last name. I'm sorry,
Malco. That's all right. Malco, nobody gets it right. You're not expected to. It's just bonus points.
And Paul is the developer of Union City Heroes role playing game, and they're putting together a. We can't talk about your other project, can we, Paul?
It's a board game deck building game. It's coming real soon. So okay. I'll take the plug.
And Paul is a big comic geek like the rest of us here at BAMF, and jumped at the chance to talk to Ron about his career and obviously Beast of the Black Hand. And hey, look, there's a wacky neighbor entering the stream. Hey, it's Walt Rebelliard. How you doing, Walt?
Jagan. Don't mind me, I've been up for 3 minutes.
Walt works nights.
Yes, which is the preferred method if you are afraid of people.
I think we just kind of unlocked the secret to Bruce Wayne here.
Which would explain all the injuries.
I've never seen Walt and Batman in the same place at the same time, now that you mention it.
You know, but you also don't want to see me in tight-fitting apparel with a giant cape. So, I was going to say, there's a guy in the neighborhood that's already got that locked down. We don't want to go there.
You have a real-life superhero in your neighborhood?
He thinks he is.
Oh man, I'm sorry. That's a thing.
Well, it's not actually Batman. It's a young kid, and I don't know what's going on. I think maybe he's on the spectrum. He walks around in a giant
Green Lantern.
I'm sorry. No, not that spectrum. I've only spoken to him a few times when I'm walking my dog. He walks around in a Doctor Strange cape with a giant Eye of Agamotto, like legit. There's no mistaking it, hanging from his neck. And he doesn't, like, you know, try and cast spells at you or anything. He's just like, right. He's like, hey, Walt, can I pet your dog? I'm like, no, sorry. You can't.
Cool. All right. You have a more colorful neighborhood than I do.
You know, it's like a nice neighborhood. It's very diverse, very suburbs. And it's just that one guy. Every once in a while you see him walking around. You're like, woo.
Okay. Well, hey, let's branch away from your life superheroes.
Yes, please.
Just a second. And let's talk about Beast of the Black Hand, Volume 2, The Viking League, coming from Ominous Press. And you guys have 3 days to go, and we're in the home stretch on the Kickstarter. So back now is the message. What can you tell us about this book, Ron?
This is the equivalent of getting together with your friends and putting on a play in the backyard. I'm buddies with Paul Harding and Matthew Dow Smith, who are the rest of the creative team on this. Paul is a sculptor for DC and Marvel and Sideshow and Gentle Giant and virtually everybody else that you would care to name. And he came up with this sort of diesel punk horror espionage concept. And I think we're sitting on his deck a couple of years ago, and he said, hey, I got this idea. Do you want to help me make it into a comic? So I said, sure. And then we cajoled Matthew Dow Smith, artist and writer, into drawing it for us. So we put together Volume 1, kickstarted it a couple of years ago, via Ominous Press, which is a publishing company that I'm part of. And so now it's time for Volume 2. It's time for the rest of the story, as they say.
Awesome.
Cool. I love this picture of Diesel Punk Iron Man punching the Demogorgon in the mouth. That's kind of cool.
It's got monsters. It's got Diesel Punk suits of mech armor. It's got worse monsters than that one later in the story. And the cast of characters, it turns out, are mostly real people. Oswald Rayner was an actual British secret agent around World War One. He was the guy that actually is believed to be the one who killed Rasputin. So Maria Rasputin, Rasputin's daughter, also a real person, plays into the story. Biffy Dunderdale, also a real person. One of the people that Ian Fleming based James Bond on. And Henry Johnson, also a real person. World War One American hero who was awarded the Medal of Freedom posthumously. The only person we made up was Olita Marchand right there. Mm-hmm. The rest of the cast is generally real people. Who, as far as we know, didn't actually fight monsters on the continent after World War One. So that's the part we're making up.
That you know of.
That we know of. That they'll admit to.
Like superheroes in a back neighborhood.
Wow, this is a really cool concept. Well, tell me about the first book. How is this continuing the story from that one?
Volume one takes place right after World War One, while the Versailles Peace Treaty Conference is happening in Paris, obviously.
And I guess we should say that's available on ominouspress.com or also here on Comixology.
Yeah, digitally Comixology. You can also get it digitally from Ominous Press. You can get the hardcover from Ominous Press. And the hardcover is oversized, sort of French album style. We did it large hardcover, sort of the lavish deluxe package first, rather than, you know, doing floppies and then a trade paperback and then the hardcover years later, which I don't know why we do that in comics. That seems to be the normal way of doing things in comics, but everybody else in publishing does, you know,
hardcovers first.
Does it the other way?
Yeah,
you get the hardcover first. So we did that. We're doing that with both of these. Volume one and volume two are both oversized hardcovers, 64 pages.
I'll go ahead.
Bunch of different covers by, you know, various and sundry artists that we, you know, arm twisted into helping us out.
Yeah, I was looking at this print here. Is this an undead Red Baron?
That is an undead Red Baron who was in volume one.
Awesome.
Wow, this is amazing stuff. I'm surprised I haven't heard about this before now.
And I saw the actual Rasputin on a page you clicked before, and I think right there too.
Yep, that's an Eric Powell variant cover that we had for the first volume, which is an amazing piece. Paul Harding actually has the original to that hanging in his studio, and if it ever disappears from his studio, certainly there would be no reason to risk to look in my office for it.
Yeah. You are above reproach, sir. Wow, that's just real. Wow, you only do this as a role playing game. Let me know because I can think of a system right now. This would be amazing. So,
yeah, I mean, that sort of stuff down the road would be great. It's very much its own sort of thing. It's our world, but it's not really our world. There's diesel punk technology and actual monsters, and the Black Hand in the title is a cabal of sorcerers that are trying to extend their dominion over Europe, and our collection of heroes are gathered to stop them. So volume two takes place mostly in Germany in the early 20s. It might come as a shock, but there were some fascists in Germany in the 20s.
What? No.
So that's a part of the story. There's a mysterious, I wouldn't even call him a hero, a mysterious character called the Teutonic Knight who will show up in the story. There's a Tom Mandrake variant cover. If you're going to do monsters, you got to call Tom Mandrake, very obviously. We're hopeful we can, you know, get over the top with pledges for the next few days and get this thing funded and finish it off. Matt's working on pages right now. He's got the first dozen or more in the can. So we've got a ways to go on the campaign, but hopefully with the cooperation, shall we say, of the audience out there, we can get this thing funded. And then the plan is to have this printed and into the fulfillment stage by December. And hopefully, you know, they won't destroy the post office between now and then, so we can actually send them to you.
That is not a firm bet, sir.
Yeah, I know. Unfortunately, so although if they destroy the post office, we might have more pressing issues than sending out Kickstarter packages. So, fingers crossed on both accounts.
Yeah,
fair enough. So I'm betting when you tell people about this, you probably get the Hellboy question a lot. You know, people wanting to compare it to that world.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an invalid comparison, certainly. Mm-hmm. Right from Rasputin showing up in both books, in both concepts. And, you know, Matthew Dow Smith's art is certainly sort of in the neighborhood of Mignola's, in that there's a lot of spotted blacks, a lot of shadows, a lot of spooky stuff. Matt actually worked on a few Hellboy things here and there in the past. So, you know, look, if you like Hellboy, you're probably going to like this, because they're cut from the same cloth to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. All right, cool. Excited to see this. Paul, did you have any questions?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, like, Hellboy is just one in a line of a pulp genre that this is clearly also, you know, a constituent part of, and something that looks great. I mean, I don't think, you know, just because both of them are doing similar stuff in a similar time period, you can think of a lot of things along the same lines. You know, like even Indiana Jones is kind of in that same mold.
Certainly, all of that pulp stuff is
kind
of the antecedent of everything here. And certainly, you know, I grew up on a lot of that stuff. Matt Smith and Paul Harding grew up on a lot of it. I know, you know, I know Mike as well, and I know the kind of stuff that Mike grew up on. And
sure.
We years ago, Mike and I haunted Powell's bookstores in Portland, Oregon for a night, and you know, Mike ended up actually buying up a lot of the paperbacks that were in the store of really kind of pulp stuff, you know, real throwback adventure spooky story stuff. And he, you know, he said, well, I've already got a lot of this, but you know, I can't leave him here for the Philistines. I got to buy him and hand him out.
Like an Indiana Jones himself saving these things,
saving the artifacts from exploitation.
This belongs in his museum. I was going to say, not to date myself or you, but I think one of the first Green Lantern comics I ever read was Green Lantern Fear Itself.
Oh, yeah, the hardcover.
Yeah, which I absolutely loved and still do. Which also has a kind of a pulp feel, right? And
Totally. Totally got fascists in it in the you know, 1940s, 1950s stuff with Alan Scott.
Yep.
That was one of the first like fully painted graphic novels. It took forever. The artist Brad Parker is terrific, but his working method was to basically photograph everything on video and then paint over it. So the process took quite a while. And obviously for a lot of it, you can't get video of Cthulhu monsters over it. So there was a lot of, you know, well, how do we do this? Do we build a model? But the whole thing, you know, it's one of my favorite Green Lantern stories, because I got to write all three Green Lanterns in Alan Scott and Hal Jordan and Kyle Rayner, sort of in their pristine periods. You know, World War II, and for Hal, kind of the 60s. We didn't come right out and say it, but really, I wrote it so that it was right in the sort of 60s space race, right stuff.
Totally. Yeah, that came through clearly. And Mike and I were saying before you jumped in, I know Kyle Rayner's my favorite Green Lantern, and I think he was saying the same or something close to it. Not to put words in your mouth.
No, that's fair. Really wish Kyle had a more prominent role in DC these days, but I think there's a lot of people with favorite characters who feel that way about DC these days, perhaps.
Oh, that sounds like a Wally West reference.
or if you I understand you're working freelancer, you have to be very diplomatic about these things on the air, so I won't press you on it, Ron.
Well, look, I mean, it's and I don't, you know, I don't mind talking about that kind of stuff. It's you know, stuff goes through cycles. And right now we're in a cycle where, you know, where Kyle and Wally aren't, you know, aren't the guys, aren't the stars. Flash and Green Lantern happen to be two of not that many franchises that you sort of get to pick your own flavor. Especially Green Lantern, and because there are so many and because you have the core, you get to pick which one is your, you know, is your Green Lantern. And to a certain extent, that's true of the Flash as well. There's obviously a bunch of different varieties. You know, to me, it's like the weather. If you, you know, if you don't like what's going on right now, you just, you wait around long enough, it changes. Certainly the people that discovered Green Lantern and Flash when Kyle and Wally were the focal points, are dedicated to them, which is awesome. Eventually that will come around again, because the people that grew up on those books, will eventually want to get their hands on those characters. So it's a cyclical process. And frankly, it's, you know, it's comics. We just make everything up anyway. So, when a good story comes along that brings those characters to the forefront, you'll see it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's what was it? Alan, happened to Man of Tomorrow. This is an imaginary story after all, aren't they all?
Oh, absolutely. That's, you know, when people ask me about continuity questions, or, you know,
yeah,
did, you know, when Marvel rebooted Star Wars continuity, and, you know, all of my Dark Horse stuff that I wrote for Star Wars was no longer canon. You know, people said, "Oh, does that bother you?" Like, you know, none of it's canon. We it's all just made up. You know, don't worry about it. You pick the stories that you like, and the ones that you like are the ones that matter to you. I don't get caught up in what's canon, what's not. They're all just made up stories, so don't worry about it.
Hear, hear.
Heresy. Walt, you had some questions?
Oh yeah, tons of questions. First of all, you had mentioned earlier that your friend came to you and said, "Hey, you know, I got this great idea for a comic." Does anybody ever come up to you and say, "Hey, I got this great idea, let's go to Vegas"?
Yeah, actually.
Okay, that's cool.
Actually, a buddy of mine who used to live here in the Albany area now lives in Vegas, and he manages Torpedo Comics, which is the comic store in Vegas, or just outside of Vegas, actually, that's owned by John Dolmayan from System of a Down.
Oh, wow.
So in fact, my buddy Will did call and say, "Hey, you want to come to Vegas? You want to come out and do a signing, and then we'll, you know, take you to some shows?" And so, so we did that last summer. So they brought me out and put me up, and we did a really great signing at Torpedo, and got to see a bunch of shows, and it was a really, it was a great time. This is in the before times when you could go to places, when you could get on a plane and go to a different place and be there for a while and then get on a plane and come back.
When places weren't just, you know, those things on your screen.
They weren't just concepts. I mean, that's actually the thing that I miss probably the most, other than, like I said, going to the gym. Because here in New York State, gyms are still verboten, and, you know, we don't know when we're going to get them back. Just the convention travel, particularly the convention travel that you use your passport for, it's like the greatest fringe benefit of this job ever. Last year I was in Saudi Arabia and Scotland and Ireland and South Africa and Kenya. Because I write comics, which is just nuts, but it's the coolest thing in the world. And now obviously nobody wants us. They won't let us in.
Yeah, well.
Bastards. The other thing I was going to ask is about a story element. You know, you have Oswald Rainer, you know, who very famously kills Rasputin. What's his relationship like with Maria in the book? Like, does she abjectly hate him for that? Does she?
Oh yeah, yeah. She's not happy about it.
To put it lightly.
Weirdly, you know, she's got some father issues. So yeah, she is in volume one. She is to great extent the pawn of the Black Hand, but she's the main villain trying to destroy the peace process and wipe out our heroes. And you know, like I said, she's an actual person. There are, you know, like crazy photos of Maria Rasputin in the 20s and 30s, maybe, like in Paris working as a lion tamer. That's a real thing. Like that was so crazy. We didn't even put it into the book, that she's in this like odd sort of military costume in a cage with lions. Yeah. Some of the stuff that actually happened is even weirder than what we put in the book. And you know, Oswald Rainer being the guy that actually killed Rasputin and the first sequence in the first volume is as near as we can figure it out is what really happened, like who was present, where it happened, and how Rasputin was killed and then wrapped in a carpet and dumped in the river. So that all plays out fairly realistically. And then, you know, monsters show up as they would when you kill Rasputin.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when, you know, when Paul came to me with this idea and said, you know, the main hero is going to be Oswald Rainer. I said, look, we can't name the hero Oswald Rainer because like, I made up a guy named Kyle Rayner and everybody's going to think I don't have an original idea in my head. And he's like, no, we have to call him that because that's his name. Like, wait, what? This is a real person. So, you know, as we got into it, I figured it out that all of these people were real. And the odd thing is that, Henry Johnson, who was one of the heroes in the book, actually lived part of his life in the Albany, New York area where I live. And I pass Henry Johnson Boulevard on a fairly regular basis.
That's funny.
But, you know, I was never really familiar with the name or the history. I just thought, you know, there's a road named after some guy named Henry Johnson. Now I get to put him in a book.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Now, where did you draw some of the inspiration for the monsters from, or was those coming from some of the art that he was doing?
That's all Paul Harding. And really the whole project came about because Paul wanted an excuse to sculpt some monsters. He was, you know, he's mostly doing, you know, superheroes and supervillains, you know, Darkseid and the Joker. And so that's mostly what his gigs are. And he was just really had a hankering to do some different monsters. So this whole project is basically an excuse for Paul to sculpt some monsters. And some of the rewards for the campaign are 3D sculpts of Paul's monster designs that Paul did. And then, you know, we printed out as 3D sculpts and put them in nice little display boxes. This is, like I said, this is the equivalent of putting a show on in your backyard with your friends. And you know, one of your friends really wanting to have monsters as part of the show. So that's how they got in there.
Yeah. Some of these sculpts are just wild. Have you gotten to see any of these in person yet?
Yeah, we printed out, for the first campaign, we printed out the figures and the busts, and man, they came out great. Because Paul is really good at what he does. These monsters aren't quite like anything else. He tried to make them as original as possible. And as kind of far afield from what he usually does, you know, Superman and Batman and all the other heroes that are his bread and butter. This is as different as he can make them.
Yeah, you, not to undercut you here, but you say like putting on a show in the backyard with your friends, and unless one of your friends is able to summon like the most amazing monsters and like diesel armor, I don't know. This looks a fair bit more impressive than that, even though they are your friends.
Well, you know, it's good to have friends who know what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, sure it is.
Especially when they're summoning monsters.
You know, honestly, that's one of the benefits of this business is that you end up working a lot with people that you have a relationship with, and you know, some of them live, you know, Paul lives half an hour down the road. Matt, when we started this, Matt Smith lived 10 minutes from Paul. So we could get together and, you know, have a few beers. Again, in the before times when you could go somewhere and have a few beers. And, you know, hash out the story and decide how we're going to do this. Paul lives in Washington, or not Paul, Matt Smith lives in Washington, D.C. now. But we still, you know, like everybody else, we still look at each other on Zoom and on Skype. That's how the creative meetings happen now.
Yeah.
Now, the covers have a pretty unique look and palette to them. Can you talk about that process of working with the artist and going about that?
Well,
covers are really striking.
Matt has a real graphic sensibility, obviously, in how he approaches the art. So the first cover, which is the red one, as we call it, the red album, is, you know, Paul came up with, or Matt came up with that design for the overall, you know, main cover for the story, and we all loved it. So when we decided to do the sequel, I said, look, we've got this hand, now we have to have this hand to match it. So the second volume cover is a blue cover with the opposite hand, and then we loved that one so much that we went, you know, we could repackage these as very limited edition single issue comics, and of you know, a chunk of page of the piece. So part of the reward structure on the campaign now is you can have the same, you can have the story that appears in volumes 1 and 2 in 4 collectible regular comic size issues, and those also have the same type cover treatment. There's one that's got an orange, you know, a hand with an orange background, and then there's one with a hand in a green background. So very much the same motif through all the covers, and the collector mentality in me really likes to put all those covers next to each other, and it looks cool.
Hell yeah! Put that in like a shadow box or something like that. Because it is kind of creepy. I mean, you know, I mean, like, just hands in general and artwork, you know, artists have been trying since, you know, whatever, to hide hands because nobody likes drawing
them. Nobody likes drawing them. So Matt uses it as the motif. And on the hardcovers, we actually use spot varnish on the covers so that the hand and the logo are shiny and the rest is matte.
Nice.
No, Matt, no pun intended.
Now, did you get to do any like crazy research, like go into a diving bell or anything like that?
No, in the fine tradition of comics everywhere, we just made it all up.
Right on. Yeah, because I mean, you got a lot of unique elements. I mean, you got the mechs, you got the diving bell, him with that helmet right there. You got cool monsters and stuff like that. So it seems to appeal to a wide variety of, yeah, there you go. Look at that sculpt. Oh my God.
Totally sick.
Yeah. I think we did a few of those in clear resin as well, which came out really cool. It's very cool to have a sculptor as part of the team, because you can do stuff like that, you know, like Matt and I look at each other and go, I don't know how he does that. That's like a magic trick.
Yeah.
Ta-da. Nice. And then it bites your head off.
You know, I've been talking to everyone I know lately about when they're getting their, Netflix deal, and I probably shouldn't ask you about that, but this book looks amazing. I'd love to see it in another media as well. But
well, that's, you know, that's part of the comics landscape now. And certainly if that comes to pass, we would love it. But I think you do the projects because you love the projects, and it's the story that you're most passionate about telling. And that's really the way it is with anything that I do. You tell that story because you're interested in telling that story. If it goes somewhere else and becomes something else, so much the better. But I think the audience can really sniff out, they can really sniff out projects that are thinly veiled Hollywood pitches.
Yeah.
You know, make the comic to be the comic, and generally good things happen after that.
Yeah.
I was going to make a snide Mark Miller joke, but I'm better than that, so I won't.
I was going to make a snide Mark Miller joke, but I'm better than that.
Mark's a, you know, Mark's a buddy. I've known Mark for years, and I think Mark's a terrific writer, and Mark is a better marketer. So the fact that he does stuff that's got wide audience appeal, and very often, you know, when Mark does a thing, you go, well, why the hell didn't I think of that?
Yeah.
When he did Starlight.
Starlight was great. I really enjoyed that.
When he did Starlight, actually, I sent Mark a note and I said, "Son of a bitch, why didn't I think of this?" Like, because he actually reached out to me and he said, "You're gonna, you know," because he knows like I'm a pulp guy, John Carter guy, Flash Gordon, all that stuff, and he is too, very much. You know, all of this honestly with Mark comes from a place of real love. He loves this stuff. And he dropped me a note and said, you know, this thing's coming. And I was like, oh my God, why didn't anybody think of this? And I think that's what a lot of Mark's things are, is they're the obvious things that you go, why didn't anybody do this already? And so, you know, so look, so more power to him. He's living the dream. He's able to make any comic he wants, with virtually any artist he wants, and put it out there in front of people, and nobody tells him no. So I think he's, you know, in a lot of ways kind of a role model. Whether you feel like some of the material pushes the boundaries and maybe crosses a line for your personal taste, right. But the overall success of what he's done by sort of bridging that Hollywood and comics gap is great, and frankly benefits the rest of us.
I was gonna say it's good for everybody, right?
Yeah. The more this stuff comes out, does well, is seen in other mediums, the more it just makes everybody else's stuff more likely to get picked up.
Yeah, I have to admit, when I heard that Miller World had a Netflix development contract, my first thought was maybe we'll get to see Starlight. That would be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, some of these. I think most of what Mark does is very sort of other media platform friendly. It just depends on, you know, Starlight's going to have a big budget attached to it. Something like Kick-Ass or Wanted didn't need big budgets, and that's why they got made already. But you know, the beauty of comics is the only budget is your imagination and the artist's time. You can put whatever you want on the page. Once it crosses over to film or TV, all of a sudden it's a little more complex because the more you show, the more it costs.
Yeah.
Well, hey, need to start wrapping things up. I've got a meeting in about 9 minutes at my soul-crushing day job over on this laptop over here. So need to wrap things up. Ron, love having you on the show. Thanks for coming out. Appreciate it. To all of our backers, sorry, to all of our listeners and viewers. Please go to Ron's Kickstarter for Beast of the Black Hand, Volume 2, The Viking League, and back it. Wow, hey, look, those numbers are going up right now as I'm talking to you. See, that's the Banff podcast bump, buddy.
Awesome.
So we're going to get you over the top. So
it's a pleasure, guys. I really appreciate it. I appreciate the time. Look, it's good to look at other faces besides my own. we're all in that boat right now.
Indeed. Paul, Walt, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, this looks amazing, and the art is crushing it. And yeah, those sculpts are wicked. So yeah, definitely. Yeah, everybody go out, get this now, immediately. Do it.
Yeah, I'll echo that. This looks awesome. Definitely looks like it's worth picking up. I just wanted to say, I just noticed that Green Lantern Silver Surfer poster right behind you, Ron. That's sick. It was a real pleasure to meet you. And yeah, we'll see you, everybody, next time.
Thanks, guys. Let's do it again soon.
Sounds good. And we'll catch you next time on the Banff Podcast. Now, there's the awkward moment before Rax